Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I'm your host, Corey Fleck, also co-hosted here by Shad Marquit. Now, Shad and I are going to be discussing a lot of the moves in commodity sector again, but we are going to kick off this show with a focus a bit more on U.S. equity markets. Quite frankly, because U.S. equity markets were just steadily climbing. You look at the Dow, S&P, NASDAQ, for the last almost 2 weeks about, boy, oh boy, these markets have been kind of boring to the upside. We started to see a little bit of weakness earlier on this week, and I know there's still a lot of bears out there saying it just doesn't make sense that these markets keep on grinding, but it was quite the environment where day after day markets were up 0.25% to 0.5%, seemingly again every day, and they all reached new all-time highs. Shad and I are kicking off this show with Jesse Felder, founder and editor of the Felder Report. Now, Jesse, one thing we were chatting about off mic that you pointed out was this dispersion that we're seeing between markets continuing to move higher and breadth that really is cratered, especially in the NASDAQ. Take us through some of the data on this dispersion that we are seeing between the markets and overall breadth, please.
Yeah, well, it's been fascinating to watch, the NASDAQ power the markets higher over the last few weeks. We saw interest rates peak out, a few months ago and turn down, and that's been really kind of bullish for this, for a rebound in the growth versus value trade. But as a result of that, we've seen, I think the Russell 2000 peaked maybe back in March, sometime in the spring, and it's just moved sideways, hasn't made a new high, since, even as the NASDAQ is powering higher. And, the NASDAQ has been taking the S&P 500 with it. But what we're seeing in the NASDAQ is literally the worst breadth readings in the history of that index, as it makes new highs. Sentiment Trader, my friend Jason Gepford, has been kind of all over this trend. He pointed out that I think it was yesterday when the NASDAQ closed at the 52-week high. It's done that on over 1,000 days, individual days, since 1984. On average, 50%, at least 50% of the stocks in the NASDAQ were advancing on the day that the market made a new high, that index. Yesterday, only 31% of the stocks were actually advancing when that index made a new high. So the vast majority of stocks actually were declining on a day that the index made a new high. And the majority of them are all below their own, moving averages, whether it's, you're talking about 50 or 200-day moving averages. I think there's a ton of stocks still trading below their 50-day moving averages within the NASDAQ, which is a pretty clear breadth warning. You can see it across different indexes too. As I mentioned, S&P's pushing new highs just because it has such a heavy weighting towards these big NASDAQ names like Apple and Microsoft. But Russell 2000's not. And you have the Dow, like you mentioned, the industrials are kind of pushing to new highs, but the transports are looking much weaker. And that's a classic Dow theory non-confirmation, which historically is kind of an economic warning. But it's also a stock market warning pointing to that breadth is just not anywhere near as healthy as it should be right now.
Well, Jesse, that's a really interesting observation. So what do you think that means under the surface of things? Because a lot of people just track the indexes, but if there's more and more people piling into a more and more narrow field of companies, what does that actually mean under the surface for the strength of these markets? Are they in danger of having a corrective move here?
I think one of the things I think is helpful to keep in mind is if you look at the pattern of the S&P 500 index going back to early 2018, to me, it looks like a megaphone pattern or a broadening top pattern, whatever you choose to call it from a technical perspective. But Edwards and McGee, in their famous technical analysis book, call this broadening top pattern, quote unquote, market out of control. And, we've seen liquidity drop dramatically in all markets, but in the stock market, especially if you look at S&P 500 futures liquidity, it's just dropped dramatically. And so we saw the stock market really take off into early 2018, the Volmageddon crash, and then stocks went up, made new highs. Powell raised interest rates, market kind of crashed into late 18 and bottomed around Christmas time of 2018. Then we saw a huge surge in the market. And then obviously the COVID crash made new lows. And so now we've pushed up to new highs again. And this latest push higher has been largely a result of a speculative mania driven by, retail traders just piling into the market like maybe we've never seen before in history. So I do think this is a stock market that's out of control. The latest rise in the market over the last, 15, 16 months is really a result of a speculative mania driven by retail traders. And if you look at this dispersion, you see it in names like, a lot of these popular meme stock names are really rolling over hard. Plug Power is one that I was watching early in the year because that was one that was a really good sentiment indicator during the dot-com mania. When that stock just screamed higher and then broke and started to crash, it was a good sign that retail fever 20 plus years ago was breaking at the same time. Plug is now down 60% off its peak. But even, things like AMC and GameStop are starting to roll over today, breaking down out of, kind of sideways or pennant patterns, however you want to call them. But if those signs are pointing to, the possibility of retail finally giving up, this retail fad starting to wane, then that's bad news for a market that has become very highly reliant on those flows into the market to push prices higher.
So Jesse, doesn't this all just tell us that we still see rotation within these markets, even though we don't have very good breadth or horrible breadth in these markets? Money's not exactly leaving the markets. It's just being focused a bit more on select stocks. And it seems like a bit more on some of these high-flying tech stocks, because I read an article earlier this week that said something about Amazon gaining around $100 billion in market cap in just 2 days of trading. So again, we're just seeing this rotation of money.
Yeah, it appears like a rotation, and that's exactly what it appeared like too in 2000. We had, the NASDAQ blew off and peaked in March of that year, rolled over, never made a new high, but then, money kind of went out of growth and into value. And then the New York Stock Exchange Composite made a new high in September of 2000. As it looked like, people are just rolling out of these crazy growth names into value. And then the market rolled in, late in 2000, early into 2001, rolled over into a bigger decline. So a lot of these rotation periods, if you look at, we've seen charts of the correlation, between indexes and between growth and value. And the last time the correlation dropped between these things so much, between growth and value, to where it was such a strong rotation as we're seeing today, was in, in the middle of 2000. When we were seeing a similar type of rotation. And to me, that rotation, in order to be sustainable, really needs to support those growth names, because they've become such a huge part of the market. So as long as the growth trade is sustainable, then the market can probably hold up. But a couple of things I'm paying close attention to. One is, a lot of this dispersion can be, potentially retail traders' participation kind of waning. But also, if you look at smart money indicators, and there's two that I pay close attention to. One is essentially the insider sell to buy ratio. We're seeing that's just literally screamed to new highs, where insider selling over the last 12 months has far outweighed insider buying. And the last time we saw this this indicator, approach anywhere near as high as it is today was kind of late 14 into early 2015. And if you remember that period, the market went nowhere over the next 12 months. We had a pretty steep sell-off in August of 2015 and then into early 2016. And so that's, to me, a sign that, the smartest of smart money, the insiders, corporate executives are getting out. There's another smart money index I pay attention to, and that is essentially just the close of trading versus the opening of trading. They say the opening of trading in the market is usually when retail are kind of piling into the markets or doing their trading. Smart money trades at the end of the day. And so when you see weakness at the end of the day relative to the beginning of the day, it's a sign that institutional investors are starting to liquidate, and that even as the S&P 500 has been moving higher over the last few weeks, that smart money index has started to roll over, which to me points to potentially institutional investors starting to lighten up on equities.
Jesse, there's a couple of interesting points there to digest for people. And it sounds like if there's a narrowing focus of retail investors piling in and the markets become dependent on that, but the breadth is so low, and if there's this end of the day selling and the institutional, are on the sell side more than the buy side, including insiders, if they are more selling than buying, doesn't that paint a picture that you're, like you're saying, that the smart money senses things are getting a little excessive, and that this reopening trade and that this inflation trade and that this, you know, now that the pandemic's passed and everybody's traveling again and they're shopping again and they're out cruising and they're, you know, flying around the country, isn't that all maybe getting a little bit ahead of itself? And isn't the smart money sensing that in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly what we're seeing, is that, you know, if you look at how all of these trends have gone, when people were locked down and couldn't, you know, go do things, then they got into trading. And now that the market is reopening, and the economy is reopening and people can get back to traveling and doing all these things, I'm seeing it. I'm on the road. I've been in, you know, Sun Valley, Idaho, and Breckenridge, Colorado, and I'm in Yellowstone now. And I'm saying everybody is out and about and doing things again. And they're going to, you know, I think we're starting to see that waning of retail trading. People are going to say, hey, you know what, I'm not locked down anymore, and hey, my trading is not working out so spectacularly. Maybe I did buy AMC or GameStop and at, you know, near the top, and it's not doing what I thought it was going to do. People are going to burn out on this. Trading is an extremely difficult thing to do consistently and successfully, and it's not something that you know, you can just read a couple posts on Reddit and make money, you know, overnight, at least not consistently. And so I think people are going to burn out on this. There's just not that many people that are able to do this successfully. It's like anything else. I mean, you know, the vast majority of people are going to be unsuccessful. Now, I really hope for their sake that you know, it's a good thing to that people are becoming interested in markets and learning and all those things, and I hope they maintain some kind of a passion for it. But I think for most people, day trading is not the most effective way to kind of express that, or that passion for the markets. And I do think we're probably going to see that fading, and we're probably seeing it fade already. And that's kind of the reason why we're seeing some of the action in the market we're seeing right now.
Yeah, makes sense. Look, that pandemic sure brought a whole new audience into the market and caused some pretty interesting market moves. But you're right, people are getting away from the markets because they're getting away from their house, finally. So that is a big change that's coming within the market. But Jesse, just encompassing this whole narrative around weak breadth in these markets, but markets still holding up there, and that move a bit more into the growth trade. How much do lower interest rates have to do with this? Because it wasn't that long ago that we were talking about a rising interest rate environment, but now we look at something like the 10-year, that's back to levels we haven't seen since February of this year, back when it was trending higher. Now rates are trending lower. How critical is that to understand about how markets could potentially be supported, especially growth?
Well, it's a great question. I think it absolutely does help to explain a lot of the rotation we've seen. Rising interest rates, typically good for value versus growth, and small cap over large cap. And so, and that's what we've seen, right? Interest rates bottomed back in March of last year, and rose until March of this year. So over that 12-month period, value outperformed growth, and small caps outperformed large caps. But rates peaked back in, you know, March, April, and started to roll over pretty hard over the last couple of weeks. And so what have we seen? We've seen growth start to outperform value again for the first time in a while. And small caps, you know, like I mentioned, have underperformed large caps. And so, yeah, that does explain it to a pretty significant degree. But that's one of the reasons why I've been looking at interest rates so carefully. But one of the things I'm seeing now is, I use DeMarc indicators for technical, you know, analysis purposes. We just saw today a daily DeMarc buy signal on the 30-year yield, which suggests rates could be bottoming here. And at the same time, we've seen tons of money pour into like ETFs like TLT. We've seen small speculators in 30-year futures just who are massively short, buying a lot of their shorts over the last couple of weeks. So I think sentiment is turning towards bullish bonds again, right as technically rates could be bottoming and turning higher again. If that's the case, then, you know, this growth stock over value and large over small could potentially reverse again.
Well, speaking of interest rates, that usually ties into currencies, and the currencies ties into other aspects of the market. So what do you think about the recent strength in the dollar, which has pressured the commodity sector? And how does that, and, you know, is that strength in the dollar something that's sustainable, and will it continue to pressure commodities, or will this move also be muted? Because we saw the commodities have a great run at the beginning of the year, and then they've just gotten kind of hammered the last couple months as the dollar was selling off. That's why the commodities ran. But now that the dollar is bouncing, they're getting creamed, and that seems to tie into the interest rate factor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all these markets are closely interrelated: interest rates and currencies and commodities. And to me, I've been saying since January, I think my first market comment I wrote of 2020 was last year. 2020 is going to be the year to watch the dollar. And I still feel that way. It's been, you know, a year and a half, and I'm still watching it as the most closely watched chart in everything I'm looking at, simply because I do think it is going to dictate the direction for a lot of different things. Obviously, you know, the oil price is probably the most important one to watch in terms of commodities. It's kind of probably the heaviest component in most commodity indexes. And it's a big driver of inflation and these things. I've been bearish on the dollar and bullish on energy for you know, at least a year now. The dollar's rolled over, but this bounce that we've seen is really, to me, not a very encouraging technical structure. If you're looking at a daily chart, yeah, I could see why you'd be maybe potentially bullish on the dollar. But any longer term, you look at a weekly or a monthly chart, and it's just bouncing off this 88, 89 horizontal support level. And until it, really kind of convincingly puts in a bottom above that, then I think we have to worry about a breakdown. Fundamentally, you know, the twin deficits are very bearish for the dollar. I think that's an important bearish driver for the currency. But in the short run, I think it's, you know, one of the things I pay close attention to. I mentioned small speculators in the long bond a minute ago. Small speculators in dollar index futures, too, have put on their biggest net long position in years, in three or four years or something recently, which tells me these kind of weak bounces in the dollar have been enough to get people really optimistic and bullish on the greenback, which is not very encouraging to me if I were a dollar bull. I'd want to see people with that's, you know, just bouncing right above long-term key horizontal support. I'd want to see people getting really bearish and worried about a breakdown, and they're doing just the opposite. We're seeing small speculators get very bullish on the dollar, and that's not a good sign. That tells me that if the dollar index does roll over again, as I think it probably will, There's a bunch of money that probably needs to, you know, get out of dollars and could catalyze that breakdown below support. Now, that would probably be, you know, obviously bullish for commodities, oil, gold, etc.
Jesse, when it comes to the dollar in particular, but also commodities, any other countries that you're watching closely? China gets referred to a lot when it comes to the commodity complex, especially what's going on in some base metals and other metals. But also considering what happens in the dollar index, what goes on in Europe too. So you focusing elsewhere on other countries, seeing any moves there?
Yeah, I think, you know, as I mentioned, I think the one I'm watching most closely is, the oil price. And I think, you know, what's driving that is a lack of, you know, production picking up in the shale space. In the past, over the last, 10 years, we've seen shale rise and become, you know, a really important player in the overall, you know, supply of oil globally. in the past, 5 years or so, when the oil price has risen, shale has ramped up production, and that's kind of kept a lid on prices. The oil price has been ripping higher, and these shale producers are not ramping up production. Nobody really wants them to. I mean, investors in the energy stocks don't want them to, and politically, nobody wants them to ramp up production either, from, ESG things to, the government wanting to be more green and et cetera, et cetera. So I think you have that from the shale side, which is kind of putting an important change in the supply dynamic that we haven't seen in years. At the same time, OPEC, obviously can't get its act together and raise production, even though the oil price is ripping higher and economies are reopening. That this combined, lid on supply paired with rapidly rising demand around the world could make for much higher oil prices over the next several months, or at least around a year or something like that. And so, I mean, I think that's something to pay really close attention to, because oil prices are so important in terms of consumer inflation expectations and, how much they play into CPI and these things. So, I think you can't really think about the inflation debate without understanding these underlying oil price dynamics. And then from a larger standpoint, too, the big commodity boom we saw, over the past 20 years was China, investing massively. Right now, we're seeing, China's still investing. And now we have a U.S. that wants to invest in infrastructure and making a greener economy. We potentially have two superpowers for the first time in history undergoing massive infrastructure investment at the same time, which is going to be a driver, I think, for a commodity super cycle over a number of years. There are famous supply constraints in all kinds of things, from copper to a lot of these commodities that go into electric vehicles. And so I think we're seeing demand come from a lot of important places all at the same time. And we've made no investment in expanding supplies. And so I do think, from a long-term perspective, we are seeing the very early innings of a commodity super cycle. And all these corrections are probably, opportunities to buy the dip.
Yeah, Jesse, just to kind of summarize what you've just said, it sounds like you're laying out a case for an increased commodity market, because you're talking about a dollar that could roll over and weaken. You're discussing the fact that there's structural challenges in the oil market that could force that higher, and oil is a huge input into the inflation side of things. And if inflation is going to run hotter, and we're in this big infrastructure build out globally, not just the United States or China, but really everywhere, the electrification of the emerging markets and the EV push and all of these different projects and initiatives are in place. Do you think that there really is legs for this commodity super cycle? Because a lot of people doubt it. And do you think inflation will be part of the driver of it?
I think there are huge legs potentially for this. If you look at past super cycles, commodities are still extremely cheap. It's amazing to me to see how much they've run up, but then to see also how cheap they are still relatively to financial assets. I mean, we're still at the cheapest levels in history in terms of, commodity index relative to the S&P or, any of those types of things. And so it tells me there's just still huge potential upside. The other side of this is, too, that the markets right now are pricing in the transitory narrative. Literally any market you want to look at is pricing in same old, same old, that we're going to have disinflation just like we've had for the last 40 years. Now, if it turns out that inflation is more than transitory, institutional investors across the board are so underweight all of the things that could make a difference to their portfolios in terms of an inflationary environment. There's massively underweight gold, massively underweight commodities, tips, all these things, even real estate. But I think commodities and gold are probably the biggest potential beneficiaries. Energy stocks, too. I mean, with the huge surge in flows into ESG funds, I think we're just starting to see ESG underperform as a result of energy stocks performing so well. But institutional investors can only tolerate that type of underperformance for so long before they're going to get fired. And if, like I said, if inflation proves to be more than transitory, And I think it's highly likely at this point that's going to be the case, just from all the drivers that we're seeing. You know, doesn't look like there's any reprieve in sight. Then the flows that are going to go into these things, that the only things that will protect you in an inflationary environment, are going to be so massive that it's going to take massive price gains in a lot of these things to close the gap between real assets and financial assets. And so there's still potential, terrific, I think, potential upside for commodities, gold, oil prices, energy stocks, et cetera.
All right, Jesse, we're going to wrap it up there. Thanks, as always, for your comments. I really enjoy reading over the Felder Report, and I really thank you for coming on our show, breaking down a kind of big picture look here at what's going on in markets and also what could come for commodities. Boy, oh boy, it's been an interesting year, and that's following 2020 that nobody saw coming. So where we go from here, big question marks, but there is still a lot of system or a lot of money in this system, just where it's going to move to next. I think that's the key consideration. Jesse, thanks as always for your time, buddy. We'll chat again soon. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Always a pleasure talking to you guys. Thanks.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Jesse Felder. In the next two segments, we are going to focus a bit more on actual investing in companies, more so exploration or smaller cap resource companies. Chad and I are chatting with Brian London. He is the editor of the Gold Newsletter, also our host down at the New Orleans Investment Conference. It is happening in kind of the mid to late part of October this year. Brian, as I mentioned on the intro here, we're going to talk a bit more on exploration companies because, quite frankly, for the precious metals investor right now, it's a tough market out there. The metals seem kind of stuck, and even more so, the stocks are continuing to lag. In no way are we seeing this whole rising tide lifting all stocks, and we're not actually even seeing gold breaking out to any significance that it's bringing in new investors. So if you want to invest in the sector, you have to focus on the companies that are doing the work that you like. Where are you focused right now, Brian? What do you like out there?
Yeah, I've been frustrated, Corey, as I know you have been, by gold and the performance in gold and silver recently. There's so many cross currents out there with treasury yields plummeting, the dollar index actually showing some strength in the midst of that. The stock market starting to roll over a bit as we speak right now. And then gold showing early session strength repeatedly and then getting sold off in the afternoons. It's hard to really place any confidence in an upward trend in gold and silver right now. The long-term view I remain extremely bullish on, but we're going through this kind of summer doldrums, a lot of cross currents in all of the markets. And you know, for that reason, I'm not really focusing on either the producers at any level or the optionality plays, but more so on the exploration plays. We have a lot of companies that are drilling right now and with results coming out and some plays that we really like. We really like their prospects. And these are the kinds of things that can go up regardless of where the market for the metals goes. You know, they're immune, have shown some immunity, and a really good drill hole is going to send a junior share price soaring regardless of what we see happening in the broader markets.
Well, Brian, as far as exploration plays, there's a couple different philosophies on how to get positioned, so I'd be curious to get your thoughts. Some people like to wait until they see a discovery hole, and then they jump on a play. Other people like to get in when they've announced drilling and get in a little bit early, but you know, maybe after they've done the capital raise. Other people like to get in private placements and get in really early, just trusting the team How do you like to get positioned in exploration plays? And, you know, in an environment like this, what would you be looking for as far as the criteria in one of these drill plays?
Well, personally, I like to get in as early as possible. Now, there are exceptions to that. We, I believe, were the first newsletter or only newsletter to recommend Philo Mining, which is a really tremendous copper, gold, copper, silver play now. But when we recommended it, it was large and fairly well established, but hadn't hit that really big hit that we thought it could. And it went up about five times in a flash from our entry level after we had recommended it when they had that big hit just a couple of months ago. So that was one where we were in kind of late and it still worked out very well, but we still saw the potential. You know, one of the things that I really like for these kinds of plays isn't so much the grassroots greenfields discovery play, but more along the lines of a rediscovery play. Companies that are valued as if they found nothing or have found nothing yet, but they're going back and finding historical projects where there has been really good drill results, but the market has completely forgotten about that. We found a few of those recently that I don't think, you know, really have achieved their potential yet. So we really like those.
Brian, one thing that is encouraging about this sector, and we've talked about it a few times, is that companies are cashed up, right? So there is a lot of money and a lot of money being spent in the markets. What do you look for when companies are announcing drill programs, when they are outlining what they're going to do with these cash piles that we haven't seen companies have in a decade that they have right now?
Yeah, they have to have the money. That's something we've always looked for. They have to have the money to put forth a really good drill program that's going to be able to prove something up and deliver a lot of assays and intercepts. You know, it's still a numbers game in exploration. And the more drill holes you can punch, the greater the likelihood that you're going to get a good result. So we do like for them to have that money to be able to get a sound, fairly comprehensive program enacted. And the good news lately is that most companies have been able to raise the money. So that box is largely ticked off for these exploration plays. Another thing you want to look for is the size of the prize. You want something that if they do hit, it's going to have that size potential that's going to really impress the market. And grade, of course. High grade is always good, but it's in vogue even more so lately that a number of companies have been able to impress the market with high grade, and the investing public kind of follows that trend and is looking for higher grade exploration projects or projects that can turn out some impressive grades.
Well, Brian, you mentioned that you really like looking at companies that are going to a past producing mine area or a brownfields operation or something where there were some known resources, maybe from a prior company, and they're reinterpreting it and they're redrilling it and they're putting a new focus on it, a new team on it. Are there any companies that have caught your eye lately that you think are doing a good job in this regard and that are maybe not getting the value they should in the marketplace yet, but you think they're doing the right kind of work and have the right kind of team?
Yeah, there's a few that I really like right now. I like Heliostar Metals with their Unga project in southwestern Alaska. It's got a few hundred thousand ounces of really high-grade resource already. And by high-grade, I mean something along the lines of 10 grams per ton. But it's a project that has never been able to enjoy a well-funded exploration outfit that can do a comprehensive program. There's a number of targets and a number of previously successful drill operations on the project, but no company has been able to really go in and figure everything out. I think they have done that largely due to the talents and expertise of Charles Funk, the CEO, who is well known for being the VPX at Vizsla Resources. So he really has a hot hand, and I think this is the second in a string of their successes, or will be known as the second big success on his resume. They just really have gotten to understand the trends and are drilling off very high grade assays almost at will at this point, but the market has yet to appreciate it. A couple of other plays that we like that are drilling right now are Scorpio Gold. They're following up on some previous historic high-grade hits on a project in Nevada. Drilling right now, results expected at any time. I like the potential for that company because the previous drill results were, again, very high-grade, very impressive. I like Ophir Gold, drilling on a project right now in Idaho, where there was an historic resource, again, not up to current standards, regulatory standards, but an historic resource of upwards of 500,000 ounces at very high grades, and even a bulk sample taken that validated those grades. All historic, not up to current 43-101 standards, but they're drilling into that historic resource to validate it and prove it right now. So I expect results from that project very soon as well. I just as in full disclosure, I own Ophir personally and Scorpio, but I do not yet own Heliostar.
Okay, thank you for that full disclosure. I know Shad owns Heliostar and Scorpio, and I own Heliostar Metals. Brent, why don't you own Heliostar? Can I ask that question?
I ask myself that question almost every day. Basically, procrastination and too busy to do something about it. And you're reminding me, I may actually go out and buy some as soon as we get off this phone call.
Okay, full disclosure there. We are recording this about halfway through the day on Thursday. So, Brian, I'll drill plays, right? And right now, hey, fair enough. If you're going to move an exploration stock, you need to have good drill results. And even in this current environment, though, we have seen some pretty good drill results not get that pop I know that the company or some shareholders would want. How are you playing some of these stocks, though, that have big drill programs underway, haven't released news yet, but sometimes stocks do run up before some of those drill results? I know the environment's a little bit different, but are you actively trading any of these stocks when it comes to getting ahead of any news or drill results being released?
I think that's a good strategy. It's not one that I typically employ because I'm really not that good of a trader, as evidenced by the fact that I still don't own Heliostar. But that is a good strategy. You know, it's oftentimes in the middle of the winter, early, you know, late December, early January, even February is a great time to buy some of these exploration plays that may have projects in the Golden Triangle, in Alaska, in the Yukon, et cetera, that won't get really much traction with the market until the summer. But they're at their annual lows around that time, forgotten at the market. And it is a good strategy to buy those companies, generally speaking, because by the time the drills get going, it oftentimes they're trading at double what they were in the middle of winter. And you can essentially take some money off the table and have close to a free ride in the stock for that drill program. This year's been weird, as you know, in that gold has been all over the place, hasn't been able to really establish a long enough uptrend and consistent enough uptrend to get the junior mining investors really excited and really bidding up prices. So, you know, there's still some companies that are drilling now that have not experienced that upswing in their share prices. So, you know, if you like the projects, it's still a good time to buy them.
Well, Brian, let me ask you a question. It may take me just a second to unpack it, but I'd love to get your thoughts on this. There seems to be like three different kinds of explorers in my mind, and that is the small companies that are doing maybe the 3,000 to 5,000 meter drill program, and they're just trying to prove that they've got something. Then there's the companies that are following up on previous drill programs. They're making progress, and maybe they have a medium-sized program, and then they have another project that they drill on a different seasonality basis in a different area. So maybe they've got two projects going. They're doing 10, 15, maybe 20,000 meters. And then there's these companies that are doing 60,000 meters, 80,000 meters, 100,000 meters, massive drill programs. They've raised a lot of money, though, and kind of diluted things down. So they've got a lot of work to do to backfill the value that they're doing. And I'm noticing that the small ones seem to get little pops and like get investors' interest when they're discoveries. But some of these companies that are doing 100,000 meters or 80,000 meters, they're not getting rewarded as much when they put out drill results every couple of weeks. But those are the kind of projects where when they put out a resource update, they tend to move the needle. How do you play these different types of drill plays or these different types of exploration plays? And then what would your exit strategy be on some of those if they do hit or if they do prove their thesis?
Yeah, it's you're exactly right. And the latter, the third example you mentioned, when these companies can raise a bunch of money and do a really massive drill program, quite often they've diluted their stock so much that their market cap may rise considerably over the course of that program, et cetera. But investors don't win at all or don't win much at all because their share price remains, you know, runs essentially sideways, even though their market cap has risen so much. So you want to generally find the sweet spot, a company that has a tight share structure that can get an adequate drill program funded. You know, and there are exceptions at either end of that spectrum, but you do want a company that can balance a comprehensive program on one or two really good projects with a still tight share structure. Those are more difficult to find, of course, but they're out there. The other thing you want to avoid are companies that are just raising enough to get a minor program done, especially on a project that really demands a lot of money to try and prove up a resource or prove up a theme. I was talking to a company yesterday that is kind of mired in that they have a great land position in one of the great gold fields in the world, but they just don't have enough money to do more than nibble around at the edges. And I had to advise them that they really just need to get a major in there on a JV, and they don't quite see that yet. So you want to avoid those kinds of plays. You want the company to be capable of proving something of significance to the market, essentially. And while there are exceptions in all those examples that you presented, you want to find a company that is in that sweet spot of share structure and financial capability.
You almost just want to see a simplicity to the story. Isn't that true, Brian? Sometimes these stories get so complex, and really there's a few things that can drive these stocks higher, and companies sometimes get, I think, a little distracted away from that, and then all of a sudden, yeah, you see a share structure that just is not that attractive to a wider audience. But hey, a lot of good comments there, Brian. Thank you, as always, for your time. I hope some people like some of those stocks. Feel free to send us any questions for Brian or for any of the companies that he brought up. And hey, Brian, have a great rest of your weekend. Great having you back on the show. Thank you for your time.
Great talking to you guys. Appreciate it.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.
Welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. Chad and I are joined by Jordan Royburn, founder and editor of the Daily Gold. And Jordan, last segment, we talked a lot about gold stocks. In this segment, I want to get some of your updates on gold's technicals and also that environment for gold stocks. Let's start off with gold's technicals here. Gold had kind of a mixed week, I guess, again this week, but quite frankly, look, gold has rebounded from about 1750 level. It's not a straight up move, but at least there's maybe a short term uptrend. Either way, still a lot of work for gold to do on the upside, I think, to bring in more investors. What are some of the key levels that you are looking at right now here, Jordan, when it comes to the gold chart?
Well, yeah, I mean, we got a short term low in gold, and what we've seen over the last couple of days or the last week or two is, we see relative weakness there, and we see gold is starting to outperform silver again, which makes sense with the macro environment. So, I mean, the rally that we're having, it's an oversold bounce. Those kind of things are indicative of a weak market. But as far as the levels for gold, I mean, I see on my screen it's up to 1812 and change. If you look at where I think the 50 and the 200 day are both right about 1833. If you're just looking at the price action itself, I could see gold getting up to the 1840 range. I think your absolute best case scenario is 1850. So my guess is we see this rally peter out around 1840-ish.
That would be another lower high for gold. That would be a continuation of this downtrend. Jordan, let's split it up between short-term and long-term. Long-term outlook, when you look at the monthly chart, even the weekly chart. Okay, look, gold still has this upward bias because of the nice run it went through 2019 through the first half of 2020. But the last about 10 months, it's almost been a short-term bear market for gold. So that's been struggling on that end. And even if the recent or next high is 1850, that's another lower high. What's your balance here between long-term, I guess, bullish still looking charts, but short-term kind of bearish charts?
Yeah, I mean, it's still in correction mode that began last August. So we're a few weeks away from 1 year of the correction. And, gold had a pretty strong move, I think 75% in 2 years, and that has to be corrected. Now, what's disappointing is not the correction. What's disappointing is the fact that gold has not been able to consolidate in a bullish fashion. And so what I mean is you have the clear resistance now at 1900 on the weekly, monthly, quarterly charts. I mean, you also have 1950 on the daily chart. You know, the high is, let's just call it near 2100. So it's in the upper 2000s there. So gold is consolidating and correcting, but I mean, it hasn't been able to trade up near the old highs. But if you go back to the 2000s when it was consolidating several times, it did so in a more bullish fashion to the way that it's doing now. So that's the disappointment, is that it's clearly correcting. It's not consolidating bullishly. I mean, I had some hope after last month, or was it after May? I had some hope after May. We got into June. Now maybe we can consolidate and build this handle in a bullish fashion. But that just went out the window. We saw huge selling at the beginning of June. So, I mean, that's where we are. I mean, we're still building the handle on this pattern. And like I said, you know, a week or two ago, gold could come down and test 1575 and the handle would still be intact. So, and the other thing with the handle, we were talking about the time. I mean, the handle could take 3 years to form. It could take another 2 years to form, and gold could come down to 1575 and consolidate for another couple of years. I'm not predicting that. I'm just saying, look, if we're taking a bird's eye view, those things are possibilities for sure, and we can't completely rule them out at this point. So yes, very big picture, long term, I'm very confident that gold is going to, you know, eventually break out of this handle. You know, my bias is I think it's going to happen sometime next year. But if I'm wrong, you know, it could be 2023, the year after. I know that sounds terrible. And, you know, what's really going to matter is a lot of the macro developments. I mean, guys like me will be looking at charts, I mean, predicting all of these things based off lines. But it's really going to be the macro developments that are going to tell us where the market will go. I mean, I know we don't have that much time, but that's possibly something we could get into unless you want to discuss something else.
Well, Jordan, I would like to just maybe take the other side of this discussion, because the focus at the beginning here was on the lower highs. But if you back up a little bit and take the macro picture on the price action, you know, we had the pandemic crash down to 1450 in gold. And then we had the March double bottom around 1673, 1675. If gold breaks that 1675 and starts heading down, that would be pretty bad. That would cause some chart damage. But if it can put in a higher low here where it may have just done that, and keep consolidating, then the move we saw higher in April and May could have been the beginning of a move higher. And yeah, we pulled back in June, but if we put in a higher low, which is, you know, the other side of the equation here, couldn't this still be part of a trend where it's gradually working its way higher?
Yeah, I mean, if I'm wrong, you would see gold on the daily chart. First, it's got to get above that high around 1905, 1910. And then it has to rally up to 1950. I mean, if gold can rally up to 1950 on this leg, then we can presume that the bottom has been in and the correction is over. I just, you know, if you look at the in real term, you know, one thing you mentioned, gold had that, you know, the COVID crash. But even, you know, immediately after the COVID crash, gold was outperforming everything. If you look at the relatives, the ratio charts, gold against the stock market, I mean, that's at a multi-year low. So gold just in real term, you know, I'm not seeing any divergences. Like, gold is not diverging as far as gold against foreign currencies. So the market is really, really weak. And I just don't have a lot of hope that it's going to, you know, rally up to 1950. But I mean, that is a case, you know, you always have to keep in mind the other case or other cases that can prove you wrong, because nobody can predict the future. And I could be wrong. I've been wrong before and I will be wrong in the future. But that's kind of that's the technical outlook right now. I mean, gold, this rally has got to get up to at least 1900, 1905, that high. And then if it can go to 1950, that would tell me the correction is over. But, you know, that's my bias, is it's going to fizzle out around 1840, 1845.
Okay. Well, that gives us some levels to watch. Jordan, what about some of the other markets that sometimes have impacts on the precious metals, either the U.S. dollar, which went through a bit of a bounce this week, and interest rates? I'm curious to hear your thoughts on interest rates, because those have been dropping. Outside of the bounce on Friday, we had the 10-year below 1.3% and continuing on a downtrend. What's your takeaway from any of the impacts from the U.S. dollar or interest rates that they could have on gold?
Well, the positive impact, I mean, we're seeing, I guess, the negative impact now on the market, but, you know, as inflation expectations come down dramatically. But the positive impact is if we see yields continue to fall, the dollar pops up a little bit more, and it hits the stock market. In the stock market, you finally get like a 15% correction, because the stock market, it looks, I mean, if you look at a number of breadth charts, I just see all these charts coming my way on Twitter, and they all make a strong argument that the stock market should correct soon. We're not even talking about a huge crash like, you know, all the gold bugs talk about daily. But just like if you get a 10 or 15% real correction because of, you have a stronger dollar, you have bond yields are coming down, so then people are worried about growth. That is something that can propel gold and gold stocks especially higher for a good medium-term rally, I would say. The downside is, in that environment, you're still going to see gold outperform silver. So that if we're looking for a bullish catalyst for gold over the next couple months, that's what it has to be, in my opinion. It has to be the stock market having a real correction. And that, you know, that could help precious metals. Maybe that's enough to take gold up to 1900 or 1950, like we were talking about before. So I would keep an eye on that. It's a little presumptuous on my part. We have to see a few more things play out. But I do think if we do get a 10 or 15% correction in the stock market, precious metals will be higher.
Well, let's shift things over to the mining stocks, Jordan, because right now, let's just say it's roughly $1,800 gold, $26 silver. It's an environment where most of the producers are still doing quite well, even though they have sold off pretty hard this week and last week. And it's an environment where development projects, you know, if they're priced anywhere close to the current levels of gold or silver, are becoming increasingly more valuable. So it's really an interesting dynamic where the sentiment is pretty bad in the sector right now, but the prices are not that bad. If you look at the long-term picture, these are great prices for producers and developers, and the explorers are going to move agnostic of the price if they make a discovery. But there has been pressure in the stock. So how are you looking at it from a big picture, you know, looking at GDX or GDXJ or SILJ? And then how do you look at it when you kind of trickle down into the juniors?
Well, I mean, on an individual stock basis, I think you have to look at things fundamentally. And I mean, I am looking at, you know, I have seen some junior producers sell off considerably. There's one I added to my watch list last week. So I am looking at, again, and we talked about this before, let's just remove metals prices from the equation when you're looking at these things, and then factor in, okay, who's going to add value over the next year or two? And, you know, I think those are the companies that you want to buy. So if you have a junior producer that's growing production, you know, they're in a healthy cash position, you know, they have the ability to grow their production materially without, you know, taking on hundreds of millions of debt or damaging their share structure. I mean, those are the things that I think you have really good entry points here. You know, maybe they have another 10 or 15% downside, but you know, in a flat market in the next 2 years from now, they can add a significant amount of value. So that's, I mean, it's easier with producers and developers to factor that in, kind of quantify their potential in this kind of market. With explorers, I mean, it's more difficult, and there's, you know, it's hard to put all the explorers in one group, but that's a lot more difficult in my opinion. There's just a lot. I mean, it's more unpredictable, and, you know, you have to look and find, see if you can find really good values. I mean, there are some that are out there, but you really have to hone in on the fundamentals, you know, what they're looking for, the odds of them finding it, then what it would be valued in the market. You know, what is their share structure going to look like in 18 months? You know, what will the value of what they find be versus the gold price? So those are the things that I'm looking at. But I think initially I'm, you know, drawn a little bit more towards growth oriented producers just because there's more predictability there right now. And I mean, explorers, you know, they can lag the market. I mean, there's always a chance you can get into those. So I would focus more on, I mean, I always say quality, but it's for me in terms of quality, I'm looking for, you know, fundamental value and their ability to add value to that project, regardless of metals prices. So that's what I would try and do. But look, we are, despite the correction, we are seeing a lot more value out there compared to just a couple months ago, and definitely compared to a year ago. So that's the good news. We are seeing a lot of quality companies that are trading at much, much better values than the recent past and the distant past.
Yeah, you raise a great point there, Jordan, because if people liked these stocks last summer in August, when they were quite a bit higher, and the companies are moving the ball down the road and companies are cashed up, they're drilling, they're doing economic studies, they're doing metallurgical work, they're doing legitimate work, they're bringing in secondary deposits into production if they're a producer, then if people liked those companies last summer at much higher levels, there is value on sale right now that people could cherry pick and you know get positioned in. But the only reason I had brought up price in the prior question was I was wondering when generalist investors are going to be interested in the sector again. And you would think at one point, if the larger seniors and some even the mid-tiers really, that middle 60, 70 companies that are producing gold and silver, when they start putting out cash flow quarter after quarter and building up their balance sheets and improving their balance sheets, is there a point where some of the generalist investors are going to say, hey, these guys have cleaned up their act, they've really turned around the mining sector to some degree compared to the sins of the past? Is there a point where generalist and analyst will come into the space just because of the fundamentals of the business? That's where I was going with the price being where it's at now.
Yeah, it's when gold outperforms the stock market, which it's not doing because the stock market's going up. Other sectors are doing really well. And because of that, they have no need to get into the larger mining companies. And also, I mean, if you look at the technicals, I mean, gold's below the 200-day. I don't know where the 400-day is off the top of my head. But if you're just looking at a long-term chart, it doesn't look good. Yeah, there's a few generalists who are going to be bargain players, and they'll buy value if it sells off again. But for the most part, it's when you see the stock market run into trouble. And, I mean, we do have to be It's great that I know that you know this. It's great that the large companies have, you know, they're in much better health. They're making money. That's all great. But, you know, the market looks forward. Gold's at 1811 right now. What happens if it drops to 1675 or, you know, 1650? So I think just technically, if I'm a generalist, I'm looking at gold and like, yeah, you know, it's consolidating, but it's weak. You know, yeah, I mean, maybe at some point I could get into it. And that some point will be when we see precious metals start to outperform the stock market. And so for that to happen, first you need a stock market correction, which we talked about before. And, you know, if that happens, we'll reassess if it's enough to really get precious metals going and sustaining it well into next year and beyond.
Yeah, good answer, Jordan, because I think it really does just come down to the overall environment for resources, right? And that's one of the tough things about mining that's outside of, say, tech, where there's an actual underlying fundamental metals price, where if you're a tech company and you can build up users, the sky's the limit, right? But with mining, you are tied to that underlying metals price. And if investors, generalists especially, see other opportunities or don't see that sector outperforming, well, naturally they get a bit distracted. What about that relationship, though, that we're seeing between metal stocks, even something like GDX and GDXJ, the ETFs? This whole week, they followed the markets. If the markets were down, they were down. Markets up, those stocks recovered. What do you make from that relationship that we're seeing right now?
I think that it's got to be driving people crazy, because you go back a couple months when we had the rally, and I probably even said at some point, I mean, I did a video. I said, look at how, you know, well the miners are outperforming the metals. This is great. And, you know, we get a move down. It's just like they can't even, you know, they're badly underperforming. But, you know, I think, I mean, to your question, when the stock market corrects, we tend to see the miners be a little more drawn towards that than the gold price. Because also when the stock market corrects, you know, that's first and foremost, that's best for the gold price. So typically, if we're at the beginning of a correction in the stock market, maybe we aren't, let's say it continues to a 15% correction, the beginning of that, you're going to see gold strengthen, relatively speaking, first. And initially, you'll see the miners sell off, you know, with the stock market. But at some point, as the correction of the stock market progresses, you'll start to see the miners dig in a little bit more. And, you know, when you get to the second half of the correction, that could be when, you know, the miners start to rebound with gold, you know, gold rebounds as well. So that's how I look at that. It's just the fact of, you know, when the broader market is going to correct, when you kind of get to a risk off mode, like we're in a little bit, the miners will initially follow the stock market more so than gold.
Okay. Jordan, great chatting with you. Thank you for taking some time on this weekend show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in. A pleasure putting together this show again and also covering a lot of stocks as we have been doing week after week. Please be sure to go back through all of our daily editorials, click on the ones that interest you, and definitely pay attention to the company ones. And keep the emails coming, either fleck@kereport.com or shad@kereport.com. We love hearing from each and every one of you, and we do our best to follow up with all of your emails and the companies that you are asking about. Jordan, everyone else, thanks for tuning in. Have a great rest of your weekend, everyone.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.